Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. After failing in February, the Colonial School District will ask residents again this June to approve a tax referendum to bolster its operating budget, a process never easy for any school district.
It's difficult to consistently go out to our community and ask them to raise taxes on themselves. At times, it really pits the school against the community and vice versa, and sometimes the community against itself.
We sit down with Colonial Superintendent Dusty Blakey to discuss the referendum and the state's current school funding landscape. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear about the latest step to bring shellfish farming to Delaware's inland bays and take a trip to the Mount Cuba Center ahead of its wildflower celebration. Plus, we bring you our latest arts playlist. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this month, the Colonial School District School Board voted to hold a second referendum, June 6th. The district's first attempt in February failed. This second attempt, again, seeks an additional 38 cents per $100 of a home's assessed value, phased in over 2 years to bolster the district's operating budget by $10.9 million. That request lost by a nearly 900-vote margin back in February. This time around, Colonial is also dropping its capital request of 1.4 cents per $100 of assessed value, which failed by 540 votes in February. That would have raised $4.7 million to install secure entrances at all district schools over the next 3 years. Colonial officials say that should this referendum fall short with voters, they'll need to make $4 million in cuts. That would require eliminating 107 jobs across all departments, increasing class sizes, and other cost-saving moves. The second referendum try comes against the backdrop of proposed state cuts to education funding offered in Governor John Carney's budget plan. His plan would cut a combined $37 million that trickles down to each school district, $22 million of which the districts could make up by unilaterally raising property taxes without a referendum. This week, I sat down with Colonial Superintendent Dusty Blakey to discuss the district's referendum attempt and the difficulties districts face with funding in the current climate.
You're coming back with this referendum with essentially the same operating budget request that you asked for in the previous one in February, and you've lost the capital request. Mm-hmm. You're also making it clear that this time the money that would be raised through the operating referendum would be essentially just to keep things running, not adding anything new or expanding programs. How optimistic are you that that will change the result this time around?
Well, I'm always optimistic. I think that one of the things that is different are people really can focus on the fact that we are what we have currently in place. And if they value what we have in place, then they will go and vote yes, because the goal here is to just continue providing the services and have additional money for growth, student growth. And so if they're really focused on the variety of programming and the quality of education their students are receiving, I think that will create an urgency that wasn't there before.
How significant has the issue of growth been in the Colonial District? It has been an issue, I understand, throughout the state. How much of an issue has it been here?
Well, we're seeing growth for the first time in a good while, though our numbers over the last 4 to 5 years in general are pretty static. What we're seeing actually is growth in special ed units. And so when we went out 4 years ago to what we have currently now, we have a little higher student population, but our overall teaching units are up by 84 units because of this growth with special education students. And even just this year, our September 30th count was 9908, and we're right about 10,000 students now. Compared to last year, our September 30th count was 9763. So we saw over 100 students growth this year, and then 75 students or so just from September 30th through early January. So we're growing. We're pleased that we're growing, but with growth also comes additional expenses. And so we're just trying to make sure that we provide that quality service to all of our students.
And you've said if this particular referendum fails, the district would need to look at about $4 million in cuts. And that's after already enacting a hiring, travel, and spending freeze immediately. You talked a little earlier about urgency. Do you think those things also create a kind of urgency that wasn't necessarily there in February for voters?
Yes. In February, we really tried to focus on the positives, focus on all the great programming that was going on, focus on the value that families were getting for what we were doing and what they were paying for it. Where this time, unfortunately, we have to focus on the what if, and we have to highlight some of the things that we're going to have to do to reserve some of our costs. Which unfortunately impacts people, impacts classroom sizes. When over 80% of your budget are really focused on people, unfortunately, that is one of the casualties of what we do. And so when we have to cut people, then programs naturally die. Other kind of services and activities will naturally dissipate. And so with that, and then classroom sizes increasing, it does have an impact on the product and what our students are getting. So I think naturally there would be people would pay attention closer to the time we get. And unfortunately, if we have to actually hand out pink slips during this time, the urgency will naturally be there because the impact will be felt fully by everyone in the community.
You mentioned the pink slips, and you're talking about 170 jobs across the board. Do you have a sense of how many of those would be teachers, paraprofessionals that are directly in the classroom with students?
We're working on that right now. Our goal is to make sure that we impact students and we impact the classroom as least as possible. To give you those exact counts, I cannot do it right now because we're really trying to be thoughtful about how we go through these cuts. All of our divisions, all of our categories, everyone will be impacted by it, but we always have an eye on making sure that we provide as many services as we can to the classroom and to the building because that's where our bread and butter is. Our job is to make sure we provide access and opportunity for our students. And so our focus is trying to preserve a quality classroom environment as much as we possibly can in kind of folding these cuts into what we're trying to do.
But is it fair to say there's no doubt that some teachers would be part of that process?
Oh, yes, there's no doubt. Unfortunately, with teachers being the largest number of employees that we have, unfortunately, yes, then there are going to be teachers that will be impacted by it. Paraprofessionals will be impacted by it. Custodians, cafeteria workers, administrators from top to bottom. But yes, classroom teachers will definitely be impacted by it.
And that's why you have to talk about class size as well.
Yes, that's definitely why we have to talk about class size. Anything that impacts what goes on in our buildings, especially teachers and paraprofessionals, has an impact directly on class size. And so if we are unfortunately eliminating positions, then that has an impact on class size. And so as we really are able to, again, thoughtfully go through this process, we are evaluating and re-examining and evaluating and re-examining everything because we want to get this right. And hopefully we don't have to go through this and live by this, but we also have to prepare for the unexpected or for the worst case scenario. So we're trying to be very thoughtful and take our time because we don't want to impact the quality of services that our kids are getting. Recognizing, though, when you lay off teachers and when you impact the people that are in your buildings, you impact class size naturally.
How much of a factor is what's going on with the state budget having on this referendum and the district's financial situation?
Well, definitely has an impact. We are hoping that the state budget kind of gets a little clearer as we get closer to the end of June. But the proposed cuts, as we've seen them now, will definitely have impact because the some of the cuts with the educational sustainment and other revenue that they are send to us also impact people, also impact positions. And so that will naturally, again, have an impact on the services that we provide. So those cuts will impact the classroom and what we're providing our kids.
The governor's proposal included an option for districts to unilaterally raise property taxes without a referendum to help bridge the gap for some of the cuts that you were talking about. Would Colonial need to do that on top of this referendum to make ends meet if these cuts go through?
That is a possibility. We are looking at that as we speak. We are actually presenting that information to our board at the end of the month on April 27th. We're going to do a workshop with our board to really go over that. We want to make sure, again, that we look at all the figures with a fine-tooth comb to present to them the best physical and economic picture that we have. But it is very possible that a match tax would have to be considered to make up any deficits that would be as a result of the budget cuts from the governor's office.
Do you worry about that having an impact on how people would vote on this referendum?
Of course. I think that any impact financially has an impact on the referendum, and we are very cognizant of what that impact has on our community. Part of our referendum is also to phase this in over 2 years, and the idea of phasing it in over 2 years is also to be thoughtful about how that any impact is of an economic impact is an impact. And so we are very clear that the governor's proposed budget, as well as our referendum, as well as the possibility of match tax, it impacts our constituents and our residents. And so we want to be very thoughtful about how we present this, not only to our school board, but to our community, and show them as much information as be as transparent as possible, but also trying to figure out ways that we can save money so that the whatever costs that we're asking for are costs that we believe are important, and that we can really show that this is how we got to this point.
We see so often with referendums, if the first attempt fails, the second attempt is successful, usually after a lower ask and or the threat of cuts and what the impact's going to be. Is this inherently a flawed process?
Well, I would say that I would like to see a different process. I think it's difficult to consistently go out to our community and ask them to raise taxes on themselves when at no other point in time do they get the opportunity to do that. And at times it really pits the school against the community and vice versa, and sometimes the community against itself. And so I think the system does have some flaws. We're hoping that the legislature and the powers that be look at it to see that, what ways that we can fix it to make it a better system. But given that what we have right now, then we are going to continue to go with it and, really invest in our community and hope our community invests back in us.
Some people have proposed as an alternative allowing districts to incrementally raise property taxes for operating budgets without a referendum up to a certain amount of money, and then require all capital referendums, capital requests be done by referendum. Is that the type of plan you would like to see ultimately?
Yeah, there are models out there. Pennsylvania, that's very close to their model that they have. The VOTEC has a system that's very similar. It's really a question of whether the school board really wants that authority. But if they are given that authority to do that, I think it would be a better system to allow us to incrementally do that. So as our enrollment increases and expenses increase with those and with the more students that you get, we can make those budgetary adjustments at the time and don't have to worry about really going out to referendum. And unfortunately, if you lose, then you have to go out or have these possible cuts out there and talking about that all the time. I think there are a lot of positive things that are happening in Delaware educationally. And this is one of the ways that we might be able to lend support to that positive atmosphere and that positive proof that's going on, is to allow the school boards the ability to do that. And that keeps up with inflation, that keeps up with our enrollment costs, that keeps up with some of the expenses that we see all the time. But it also, we're held accountable to do that because school boards are elected members of the community. And so if the community doesn't feel like they're doing their job, then they have the ability to vote them out. And so I think there is that fail-safe that's in place.
In the interim, is the key, as you alluded to earlier, the idea of communication, transparency, and making the case in a way that people feel like they're getting the whole story?
Yes, I think that's very key. People really need to understand how school financing works, need to understand how the school district works, understand when they see money being spent on this or that, where that money actually comes from, and the value that they're receiving in their students' education or the education within the community, and understand that property values are tied to the successes of schools, and really look at the bigger picture. But I think we have to be very upfront. We have to be as transparent as possible. We have to be willing to have that give and take conversation with our community, but also invite our community in to say, hey, our schools are open. We want you to come see what we're doing. We are proud of what we're doing, and that's what we do in Colonial. We really try to focus, and we invite our community in at any time. They're welcome to come in. We'll take them around the district. They can see what's going on live in real time. and get a real sense of the value that they have in the, that's going on in their school system.
Thanks to Colonial Superintendent Dusty Blakey for his time on The Green this week. Again, the Colonial School District's second attempt at a tax referendum is set for June 6th. And The Green continues in just a moment with science reporter Katie Pike is telling us about the latest step forward in getting shellfish farming up and running on Delaware's inland bays. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware shellfish enthusiasts are a step closer to raising oysters and clams locally. A lottery will be held in early May for watermen interested in securing spots to raise shellfish in Delaware's inland bays. It's taken the state years to get to this point, and Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus explains why and what concerns remain.
In 2003, the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays used a grant to launch an oyster gardening program in Lewis. John Ewart is an aquaculture specialist with the University of Delaware. UD provides the center with spat. He says the program was an effort to bring oyster populations up to clean the waters, not put them on the market. It now has 70 oyster gardening locations in the inland bays.
We're able to get mature oyster larvae from the Rutgers hatchery across the bay, and we have a pile of shell here, that recycled shell, and we get it all set up in the tank and flood it with aerated seawater, and when the larvae are mature and ready to set, we flood the tank with larvae and they attach themselves to the shell.
The program's success led to a new question. Is commercial shellfish aquaculture feasible in the inland bays? In 2013, Ewart and others pushed the state to allow for commercial harvesting. Regulations were put into place in 2014, but the actual launch of commercial harvesting has stalled for 3 years, delayed by concerns from a number of nearby homeowners and a lengthy Army Corps of Engineers permitting process. One of the groups that opposes the regulations is the Coalition for Little Assawoman Bay. Their original concern was the number of sites, 118 acres worth.
And they were being placed right in the area where most of the recreation on the bay takes place, you know, near the shore.
Diane Maddox is the founder of the group. She says the group is relieved the acres available have been lowered to 43. But another concern remains. Pipes sticking 5 feet out of the water to identify clam plots, which opponents call an eyesore. She says these markings are unnecessary since the bay has been restricted to hard clams only.
If you're growing oysters, they grow in wire cages and they float on the water line. So to keep people from bumping into the cages, that's why they wanted to put these pole markers on each 1 acre plot.
But she says hard clams are grown on the bottom of water in nets, and they don't need poles or pipes to show where they are. Maddox says the group has asked DENREC to change the regulations, but legislators would have to amend the existing law. They have not heard back from DENREC yet. Maddox says she thinks the state was just eager to get the program going. DENREC will hold a leasing lottery on May 2nd, drawing names from a pool until there is no more acres left in the inland bays. Stephen Friend is the owner of Friend's Clams in Georgetown, which distributes non-locally grown clams. He has been waiting to farm hard clams and oysters for a while and is excited for Delaware's program to get started. But he worries people more committed to shellfish farming, like himself, won't get leases.
Anybody in the public out here can go ahead and do it, and it's holding up us that really want to do the job. You know what I'm saying?
It can take at least 2 years to grow oysters, so Friend says he's concerned many hobbyists may have to wait longer than they think to see results. He's already spent more than $70,000 on equipment and has 185 cages ready to go into Rehoboth and Little Assawoman Bays. DENREC did not respond to questions about how many leases are available or how many people have submitted paperwork for the lottery so far. Last winter, former DENREC Secretary David Small said up to 70 participants could lease 5 acres each. And once the leases are awarded, Chris Basin, the director for the Center of the Inland Bays, expects the program to benefit Sussex County significantly.
It's a brand new industry for Delaware that really hits the sweet spot where the farms are cleaning up the water while they're providing jobs and putting local seafoods on people's table.
Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie. Applications to be included in the Shellfish Farm Lease Lottery are due by April 26th. And stay with us. There's much more to come on The Green. But first, we have a look at your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. April is Autism Awareness Month, and this week we're sharing the story of a remarkable transformation for one boy living with autism and his family. Wilmington native and former Wall Street Journal reporter Ron Suskind's son, Owen, was diagnosed with late-onset autism when he was 2.5, and he started to lose his speech. He didn't talk for a long while, and eventually started connecting with his parents and brother through animated characters, engaging in Disney dialogue. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly spoke with Ron Suskind about his business, Sidekicks, inspired by Owen's special connection to Disney, and research he's involved with about the affinities of those with autism.
I understand that his akin with Disney is termed an affinity, and you're trying to find out if other kids with autism on the autism spectrum might be able to use a similar technique as Owen to communicate.
That's right. 3 years ago, when the book Life Animated was published, we were beset by parents from all over the world who called and said, I get it now. I see that my kid uses these passions that were often seen as obsessions. And now I think the view is that they're not. They're not so much prisms as pathways. So that's the way spectrum people process the world, through their passions. Mm-hmm. And so Cornelia and I said, how can we create a scalable, easy-to-use version of ourselves that other parents can use, no matter what the child's passion is, what their interest is? So we grabbed a couple of the leading technologists in the country, including one of the founders of Siri, and other leading technologists and neuroscientists and specialists in autism. And we brought them together in a consortium and built a new kind of augmentative supportive technology called Sidekicks, named by Owen himself. And it's right now available to people if they go to sidekicks.com. It's also available on the App Store. It's a free download. And what it does is it allows a parent to share on connected iPhones or devices of any kind, computer to phone, iPad, share whatever the child's passion is, and help them use this passion to identify emotions and regulate them, to arrive at deepened insights, to essentially grow and become more independent. It's very much next generation technology that is easily accessible for parents to use.
Have you heard from parents who have found it helpful?
Yes, indeed. We had about 100 parents that were active in a pilot we did over the last year, and they were the results were quite the early results were quite striking. Children, of course, were joyful. Several of the children showed growth in emotional regulation and identification, in growth in speech, and really built capacities to connect. The way it works is that the child downloads avatars on his or her phone. When the parent talks or types into their phone or computer, it comes through in real time in the voice of the character on the child's phone. The child talks to the character, and you can hear it wherever you are. You can carry on a conversation that breathes life into a virtual assistant for the child. And that virtual assistant grows in automation through usage.
And I saw that you have also launched an affinity survey with Autism Speaks.
Yeah, that's right. So so about a month ago, Autism Speaks and we partnered to do the first ever comprehensive survey of affinities among the autistic spectrum population in the United States. That survey is completed. We're right now analyzing the data, and we'll be releasing that in a white paper in the next few weeks. And it's quite extraordinary, actually. I mean, what we found is that the affinities are quite diverse across a wide landscape of interests. And what we began to understand is that many, many folks in the spectrum use affinities in ways that are similar in terms of activity and mm-hmm. incentive and capacity, similar to the way that we help Owen use Disney. People like their affinities. They use them. One of the things that we found in our research is that the way they, and it's a very nice phrase in one of our leading, we have lots of the leading autism specialists working with us, is that they use these affinities as code breakers to crack the code of themselves, their relationship with others, their place in the world. They draw from these deep areas of expertise. They draw from them what they need to make their way in the world with enormous improvisational and creative energy. That's what's so interesting about it. Owen turned Disney, the lyrics and dialogue from Disney, hundreds of hours of it, into his own form of communication. He invented his own emotional language using dialogue and lyric. Folks in the spectrum do this with almost every single affinity they have, from dinosaurs to astrophysics. Thereby drawing from it deeper meanings, deeper capacities, and using it to get what they need to make their way in the world.
Sure. Have there been any other patterns kind of that have arose from any of the research about maybe other movies or books or just any other kind of mediums of affinities?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, there's obviously a lot of folks on the spectrum like movies, like The Moving Image. But it's quite diverse, you know. There are folks who do what we did with Owen. They do it with trains, with maps, with astronomy, with paleontology. I'll give you one example to help people mm-hmm. understand how it works, that they do this with anything they embrace. And the choice is what they embrace.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. That's a choice they make. And it's a choice they make in terms of what nourishes them and the way their neurology is constructed. Again, it's just like the rest of us with the interests that we have. We just tend to move around a bit more. We probably, in general, folks have a more diverse array of interests. And we don't rely on these passions quite in the way that folks on the spectrum do. Of course, it's also the way many famous artists do.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, folks with powerful expressions in many disciplines. But here's an example. A young lady came up to me at a speech recently, and I said, "So what's your thing?" She says, "Well, I'm, you know, paleontology. I love dinosaurs." I said, "Great. So mm-hmm. teach me something. What's your favorite dinosaur?" And she said, "Well, you know, I don't want to tell you because you'll laugh. Everybody laughs when I tell them ever since Jurassic Park." I said, "Okay, I promise I won't laugh." It's okay. "Well, my favorite dinosaur is the Velociraptor." I said, "Okay, I get it. Why they laugh? That's a monstrous, bloodthirsty animal." And she's like, "I know." She says, "But here's the thing. You see, the Velociraptors are pack animals. That means they move in packs and groups. Now, inside of the pack, of course, they're not all the same. Like any group of animals or anything mm-hmm. at all, they're diverse. And so the key is they have to understand who in the pack does what well. And if they work together, they can take down a much larger dinosaur. So it's about mm-hmm. interdependency
mm-hmm.
and about seeing the qualities in others and as well as those seeing those qualities in us.
Wow, what a deep deep answer.
Yeah. Now, I'm telling you, there's not a paleontologist in the world that would come up with that.
Right.
But here's a young lady
who, what she does is she's drawing from her passion what she needs to make her way in the world. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's what we all do with the passions that we have. We find in these interests, these powerful, affinities. We find in them what we need to sustain ourselves, to nourish ourselves, to help us know ourselves. And folks in the spectrum do that with a kind of force and intensity, and in many cases, brilliance that is beyond the rest of us.
Thanks to Warmick and Pauly and Ron Susskind for their time this week on The Green. Susskind says Owen is doing very well. He's living in a supported independent living condo in Cape Cod, painting Disney-inspired artwork and working for Regal Cinema. The Green continues in just a moment with our latest arts playlist. Stick around. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A delegation from one of Wilmington's sister cities, Oshkobo, Nigeria, traveled to the First State recently, bringing with it 20 works of art. In this edition of Arts Playlist, our Mark Earhart talks with Chefon Taylor of the Wilmington Office of Cultural Affairs about the two Nigerian artists whose work is featured in the city's Art on the Town, also known as the Wilmington Art Loop.
Art on the Town, also known as the Art Loop in Wilmington, opened this spring with work from two Nigerian artists. What can you tell us about them as artists and their work?
So for this particular exhibition, we were able to have two artists who are both chiefs in Nigeria. One artist who is Chief Morena Oyelami, he did a collection of oil paintings. And with those oil paintings, he really gives his audience an opportunity to dive into his experiences, stories, folktales, and some really great landscapes in Oshkobo. And our second artist, who is Chief Jimo Boraimo, he actually put together a collection of oil paint and bead on wood, which were really vibrant, extraordinary pieces of art. And they are both really well-known artists in Nigeria and have put together some really great collections, have been able to curate some really great exhibitions with the National Museum in Oshkobo in Nigeria. So it was really an honor to have them show here at the Reading Gallery in the City County Building. They did a preview party. There were drummers. A number of the other chiefs from the Nigerian delegation were present. So it was just a really great opportunity to have them, present here in the building.
And both artists are from Oshkobo, the sister city to Wilmington, one of the many sister cities.
Correct. That is correct. Chief Oyelami, who was the first artist that I mentioned, is the chief of his village a few miles right outside of Oshkobo. So just for a little context there.
So how does showcasing their work help us identify what makes us both different as a culture and the same as the people of Oshkobo?
So I think the great thing about art in general is that it lends us this really unique opportunity to enter dialogue and conversations about culture that we may not know where to start in just regular, everyday conversations. And those conversations are inclusive of people, places, practices, and so much more. So when you have an opportunity to look at either the chief's work, you begin to just ask questions, who is this person and what do these colors represent and what is this place? And it becomes this long story of what they experience culturally in Oshkobo in Nigeria. And the byproduct of those particular interactions is just a deeper connectedness to the people and the things that we don't know anything about or may have some preconceived notions of, really. And I think at a high level, we can recognize what looks like African art, but to begin to be able to make distinctions between tribes and villages and countries and different cultural practices amongst the different people, art really lends that because you really start to see the nuances, the complexities around the work, which is a direct reflection of their actual experiences and world.
So describe what people will see and experience as they're walking through this art loop this spring.
So what I think that people will experience overall with the exhibition are two related but completely different experiences between the artists and their relationship with Oshkobo, Nigeria. So you have Chief Jomo, who has put together a really great collection of oil paint and bead on wood that is really vibrant, really intricate, and tells a number of stories related to family and connectedness and friendship. And then you also have the work of Chief Oyelami, who has put together a collection of oil paintings that are more subtle, more subdued, but still tell these larger stories, complete this larger narrative of togetherness, of family, even some of womanhood, and some of the landscape there in Nigeria. So I think between the two artists and the collections that they've put together, you really do enter with a full view of what Oshkobo, Nigeria, and these particular artists represent.
And what did they think of Wilmington? Any ideas?
That's actually a good question. I think that for them, it was as much as an honor for them to be here as I thought it was for them to be here, which was really an interesting experience to have. And they loved the idea of, you know, being able to connect with the mayor and to connect with the city overall. And I think a lot of times, you know, when we're here in the States, when we're here in Wilmington, we have a tendency to oversee what our own cultural resources and assets are because we think other countries have this really, really, really rich culture. So I think the other thing about having the Chiefs here was this opportunity for them to appreciate Wilmington, which, you know, allows all of us, specifically in this instance, me, to just have a deeper appreciation of the cultural vibrancy of the place that I live in.
And has the city done this before, taken sister city art to put it on display?
This is the first time that the art loop or art on the town has connected with sister cities, and it was such a rich experience, and really grateful for Chief Amawale and Dennis Shear, the executive director of Sister Cities, for thinking more deeply about, you know, what our partnership could look like and how arts and culture can intersect those things. So this was the first opportunity that Sister Cities had to bring in artists to partner with Art on a Town, and would absolutely do it again.
Yeah, and it looks like you can have opportunities. Wilmington has, what, six sister cities?
Yes, there are six sister cities that began with the Swedish landing in 1963, and then over the years there have been formal relationships with six sister cities. That includes Kalmar in Sweden, Watford, England, Fulda, Germany, Oshkobo, Nigeria, a city in Italy, and then also Nemours in France. So hopeful to be able to at some point perhaps partner with all six of our sister cities to do more arts and cultural events, experiences, such as the exhibition we have now in the City County building.
And how long will their work be up at the Reading Gallery? That's at the in the lobby of the City County building there on North French Street.
So the artwork will be on display until April the 28th, and that is a Friday.
Siobhan Taylor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Our thanks to Mark Earhart and Siobhan Taylor of the Wilmington Office of Cultural Affairs for their time this week on The Green. The Oshkobo Chief's artwork is on display in the Reading Gallery, located in the lobby of the City County Building in Wilmington. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a trip to the Mount Cuba Center for a preview of its wildflower celebration. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Toward the end of this month, Delawareans will have a chance to indulge their love of wildflowers near the tip of the 12-mile circle. For this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson takes us on a field trip to the Mount Cuba Center near Hokesson.
On a recent trip to Mount Cuba, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to find. Small snowbanks line the spiral driveway just days after temperatures nearly reached 70 during a February heat wave, but the main garden was green and ready to pop with life. Victor Pyatt, the gardens manager at Mount Cuba Center, shows me a nearby tulip display that will encircle a brick walkway near the back of the main courtyard.
If these tulips had been in bud and were opening, absolutely it would have destroyed the flowers. If the buds were down inside and they were still tight, it would sort of blanket it and insulate it. They should be okay.
Had the warmth lasted just a few more days, plants could have started blooming, leaving their tender buds exposed. Pyatt says they could have been blasted by the subsequent freeze, silencing what would have been a colorful spring orchestra.
What would you have done if the buds would have gotten blasted?
Probably cried, because can't do anything at this point.
And they've dealt with that in the past. Pyatt says he trucked in heat lamps one year, covering the tulips in a makeshift greenhouse to protect them from the frost.
It's roulette, it really is. You don't know what it's going to do. I don't think anybody was really expecting this, the late snow, but it's great for the water table to recharge, so I'm not complaining about it at all. And it's going away nicely. It hasn't really created much of a problem for us.
After an inspection, Pyatt lays out the garden's first planned display in his 25-year career at Mount Cuba, beginning in the South Garden. Visitors will enter straight from the main house after walking through two brick pillars guarded by stone eagles.
You're going to see a progression of color through the season, starting, I believe it's April, and it'll go all the way into the fall. It'll start with pastels, and then it'll go to the warmer summer colors. So blues, yellows, oh my, some pinks.
From there, you'll walk straight back toward the now flowering tulips we inspected earlier. A short hike over a well-manicured lawn plops you next to fragrant lilac bushes that should be ready to bloom. Thankfully, they also escaped much of the frost damage.
Just some of the outer bud covering, these scales, they got a little burned or chilled, it looks like, but the buds are okay. They can take quite a bit of cold.
A sweet floral smell carries over into the woods path a few steps away, and here's where Mount Cuba stakes its reputation. Close to the ground, that's where you'll find most of the varietals of trillium native to the eastern United States.
A lot of them, you'll see they've got this mottled foliage, and that's one of the attractive features about it. The flowers can be, I've seen them white, like yellow, and a maroon color, and it's three petals. Some petals are upright, other ones are spreading, and other ones are nodding.
When I visited, they were still waiting for a bit more sunshine to perk up and bloom, but are expected to put on a show by the end of April in time for the organization's annual wildflower celebration. The walkway through the trees will grow lush as the summer progresses. It's one of Pyatt's favorite places on the dozens of acres of property he oversees.
This room just gets created. It's really neat. It's like the paint goes on. And it's a completely different feel. As the tulip poplars leaf out, you really get that cathedral feel as you walk down the woods path.
2016 was the first year Mount Cuba allowed visitors 5 days a week. Originally owned by Lamont DuPont and Pamela Copeland, the private gardens only opened to the public in the 1980s through guided tours. It has since allowed visitors to stroll through the grounds at their own pace since 2013 and established classes for home gardeners to learn about growing plants native to the eastern Piedmont. The 13th annual wildflower celebration kicks off Sunday, April 23rd. The first 1,000 families receive a free chocolate white snake root plant boasting white flowers and dark burgundy leaves. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James, for enlightening us this week. To learn more about the Mount Cuba Center and its wildflower celebration later this month, you can visit the Mount Cuba Center website at mountcubacenter.org. And that's all for this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, Megan Pauly, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts.
For all of them and the rest of the Delaware Public Media staff, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us. The Green is on spring break next week, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.